I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe. And
welcome to show 4 of Integral Life's teleseminar, Love, Not War, Going Home for the Holidays. I'm David Reardon, and I'm your host tonight as we bring you the 4th show in our 5-part Home for the Holidays series. And tonight, I'm joined by Susan Hodges, our integral coach for the series. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, David. Welcome again, everyone. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Nice to have you on board tonight, Susan. For those of you who haven't listened to last week's show yet, Susan finished the 3 coaching sessions with her client, Hui Lam, and then we sent him on his way to be with his family during the holiday season. So tonight, Susan and I are going to explore the 3 things we want you and the audience to consider taking home with you when you visit with your family and friends. And you might be asking, what are these 3 things, these must-have inquiries for the holiday season? So here they are. Number 1, what are your expectations for your visit with your family? Number 2, how are you going to do whatever it is you're going to do with skillful means, i.e., how are you actually going to do it in a way that it might work? And 3, how can you manage your emotions when they do come up? And they will come up. We all know that, both positively and negatively. So how are you actually going to manage those emotions as they come up around your family? Now, we're going to look at these 3 questions from many points of view tonight as we review the practice we asked you to engage with during this last week. And you will hear them again as Susan reflects on the universal themes that emerged out of we and Susan's 3 coaching sessions. And then they'll be there again in the 3 holiday stories that members of the audience sent us that we have chosen to highlight tonight. So a lot of really interesting perspectives to get to tonight, but first let me do some housekeeping. I want to remind any of you on the call tonight or those that have downloaded show 4, if you have not yet listened to show 1, 2, or 3, you can download the recordings for those shows on the Home for the Holidays webpage. To access these 3 recordings, go to www.integrallife.com and click on the Home for the Holidays medallion on the left side of the homepage, and then follow the links to show 1 or show 2 or show 3. You'll see the little medallions right there with each show numbered. You will also find the practice that was suggested for all of you to reflect on during this week between shows 3 and 4, otherwise last week and this week, and that's behind the medallion that accompanies the show 3 recording. Also, as we've announced, we are giving away 3 integral coaching sessions to one lucky and deserving winner of our Home for the Holidays contest. We have selected 3 audience stories from the many that were sent in to highlight during tonight's show. We want you all to listen to these 3 stories when we present them later on and decide which of our 3 semifinalists you feel deserves the 3 coaching sessions prize. And later in the show, I will let you know exactly how you can vote for the story of your choice. So let's jump into reviewing the practice we asked you to engage with this week. This is going to be the first opportunity for you to think about your responses to our 3 take-home inquiries. Everything you achieve this holiday season with your family, all the richness, all the love, is going to start with the intentions you set and hold each and every day for the next 3 weeks. You are capable of doing so. The question is really, are you paying attention? So here we go. Answer honestly. What would I like the qualities of my connection to be with each family member during this holiday season? These are your intentions that you hold for this time. For each one, what shifts and changes would be required of you to step up and take responsibility for unleashing the deep love that is dying to be released? And despite putting forth great effort, this question is going to stretch you. At this point, your perspective derives from your current way of seeing your family and yourself. In other words, you have to develop the ability to take your current way of relating to your family as something you can see, which is why it is so helpful to work with an integral coach who can help you do just that. So the next thing we want to do is reflect upon these 5 considerations. 1, can you take the perspective of another person? to, can you comfortably stay present when another person exhibits intense emotions? It's a tough one. 3, can you see your own part in the pattern? Of course, this is the hardest thing for all of us to do. We certainly can see it in other people, but you know, how are we playing a part in whatever's going on? 4, can you stay in your own body when triggered? And that's really just feeling into being present, what's happening in your body, where this tension may be arising, if it is, and just can you be aware of that in the moment? And 5, can you feel emotions without being overcome by them? So certainly they're going to come up. The question is, what are you going to do with them? Each of these considerations pertains to a specific developmental muscle. How might building any or all of them support you in changing the way you interact with your family? So I thought we'd ask our coach, what do you think, Susan? How are these 5 considerations, how should the audience be holding these?
Well, I'd like to offer our audience one practice, and they can pick the muscle that they'd like to develop. But I'd like to offer them something that they can be doing, or you, our audience, and what you can be doing over this next week. So each of these questions pertain to a muscle, as David said. And what you can do is choose a simple new behavior to do 2 to 3 times a day. And there's a reason for keeping it simple. It allows you to feel challenged but not totally overwhelmed. So many of you will know you'll start an ambitious project and you'll give up on it because it's too much all at once. So start small, and you're more likely to be able to follow through. But not only that, having a simple, novel behavior that's also concrete can make it easier for you to find out when you go home with your family how much of an impact has your practice had on your ability to show up with them in a different way, and potentially to have them interact with you in a different way. So for example, if you realize that you need to build a muscle of taking the perspective of another person, you could practice when listening to someone express an opinion. And as you do, you might imagine what it must be like to really be this person. You know, really allow yourself to feel into what it's like to be this person in front of you. Why might they hold that opinion? And feel the heart behind it and all the care that goes into it. And really see if you can feel the compassion that you might have for yourself. Another example is if you want to develop the ability to stay comfortable and present when someone else exhibits intense emotions. And when I say comfortable, I don't mean laissez-faire. I mean that you're able to just feel like you're okay. You're able to stay present and you're okay. You're not charged up in a reactive way. You might begin by noticing when you start feeling uncomfortable. And what do you do when you feel uncomfortable? And just see if you can simply return to noticing your own breath and feeling that in your belly and allowing yourself just to act as a witness to this other person's emotional experience without getting attached to having a particular outcome. A third example is that if you sense the benefit from building the muscle of feeling emotions without being overcome by them, you might start by just naming your emotions if that's difficult for you. What exactly is arising in you? And along with that, what's happening in your body? And just bring a gentle, compassionate curiosity to this observation. And again, like following the breath, just stay with describing the experience itself, not evaluating it in a judgmental way, but just describing what's actually happening. Similarly, if you struggle with staying in your own body when emotionally triggered, just begin to notice your breathing again as it flows in and out of your body. And particularly notice your arms and your legs. Feel your awareness ground itself firmly back in your body, like I'm here right now. And it's very important that you feel your legs connected to the ground beneath you, supporting you and keeping you steady. So it's helping you maintain a sense of your own strength and stability. And as I said, you might be able to also say in that moment, I'm here and I'm safe. I can take care of myself. And as a last example, if you would like to become better at seeing your part in perpetuating a particular relationship pattern, you might want to start by trying to catch yourself in the act. So, oh, there I go again. And in that moment, what is the internal dialogue playing out? What conversations are you having in your own head that kind of get you tripped up in that loop? And then what emotions and body sensations are correlated with that? What are you experiencing? So notice again, we're bringing the attention to self, not what's happening in the other people so much, but what's happening with you. And then given the conversations and the emotional and physical sensations you're having, how might those perpetuate your wanting to do a certain set of behaviors that keep leading to ends that you don't like? And what might you do differently? So in light of any of these muscles or a muscle that you want to develop that might be different, take about 15 minutes at the end of each day and write down what you're learning as you're trying that new simple behavior. And be sure to record the specific context in which you tried the behavior, because contextual factors are really important. They serve as cues that can tell you if specific things are more challenging for you or if it's easier for you to exercise that muscle in a certain way. So you might be able to surround yourself with more supportive environments at first as you're doing that muscle building and it becomes stronger. You might also want to note what becomes available to you when you follow through with your new action. What new positive things happened? And then thinking ahead when you go home for the holidays, if you were to continue practicing these new actions with your family, what impact do you think you might have on each family member? And that is a stretch to, again, help you to start thinking about how they might experience you behaving differently and how you might be able to adjust that to each person. So, and lastly, I always tell my clients this. It's so important. Please take time to acknowledge yourself for being in the practice. And acknowledge the care and the energy and the risk that you invested in delving into this. Oftentimes we push ourselves so hard and we don't acknowledge just the heart behind our intentions. And so I'd like to leave that with the audience.
Thank you, Susan. I know when I engaged in this practice, you know, all kinds of useful things came up as it relates to the three questions that we started the show with tonight. So before we go to our three audience stories, which are coming up, let's transition to what we actually learned during the three coaching sessions with We. And given our three questions, and let me just remind everybody what they are again. What are your expectations for your visit with your family? How are you going to do whatever you do with skillful means? And how can you manage your emotions when they do come up? Susan, could you review We's coaching process and the muscles that you are helping him develop as it relates to these three questions?
Sure. So this first question, it has to do with our assumptions and expectations about what's possible when we interact with our family members. So in Hui's case, if you remember, he's come to value having deep, intimate, growth-oriented conversations with others. And his expectation in receiving coaching was that he could make that happen with his family and that they'd want to meet him equally. So through the coaching process, we became aware of his tendency to not self-disclose. And not only that, he found that he didn't usually check in with his family members about what they were experiencing and what their expectations were. So we needed to start helping him come out a bit more and also check in with them to dive into their experience. So I would invite all of us to ask, what are our assumptions and expectations when we visit our family? Okay. Now notice if you immediately thought about how you'd like your family members to interact with you. It's so automatic to do that, and yet, as adults, we're responsible for controlling ourselves and not other people. And it's so tempting to hope that other people will relate to us differently, and yet the struggle we have is how do we move differently and how do we even embrace ourselves when we don't do what we hope we'd like ourselves to do.
And yeah, it was interesting on this one in particular, because Wee's story, and we're going to hear another one tonight, which is in a certain sense kind of similar, but I'm going to let you sort that out. And that is this expectation for those of us that do all this development work, that if the expectation is that your family is going to somehow meet you at that level of intensity that we all normally go through in our given days, because we do this, a great deal of the time. And in Wee's case, he's coaching all the time.
Yeah.
That expectation really needs to get looked at, and to say, is there any way possible with our families that they can actually come up to this level of intensity that we all feel in our lives that, when we deal with all this stuff? And the answer probably is maybe not. And then there's just, a way to take a look and meet them really where they are. So thanks.
That's right.
Thanks for that.
I'd like to add, too, that if we're immersed in communities who value development and we don't see our family members very often and they're not in those communities, it's almost like a fish swimming around in water. We don't know that we're in water. And suddenly we find ourselves in family and we think we're still in the same water. And it's realizing that maybe we're on land now. And so it can be a bit jarring. Yeah. So the second question is, how are you going to do whatever you do with skillful means? So if you want to interact skillfully with others, it's critical to unearth our own values and expectations. Because, as I said, others may not share them. So a corollary is to cultivate the art of taking the perspective of our family members and to see our part in perpetuating the particular relationship pattern. So to reiterate, in Hui's case, his father, the general, he was an army general, communicates on a need-to-know basis. And Hui managed himself by withdrawing energetically and emotionally by going into don't worry, be happy. So for Hui, what we worked on was to help him take his father's perspective as well as his own. In some ways, don't worry, be happy had a difficult time taking certain perspectives for Hui himself, particularly the negative emotions that he was experiencing. So Hui realized that having a deep, authentic conversation with his father might actually not be possible. And so the insight helped him to recalibrate his expectations and then consider how he might be able to stay present to his distress that comes up sometimes when he's with his dad and to still meet his father in a way that his father could understand, in a way that Hui wasn't just going off into don't worry, be happy, that it still felt a bit more authentic for him. So we benefit from doing the same. But otherwise if we don't check in with someone else's experience and notice our own ways of creating a pattern, it really isn't fair for us to expect our family members to interact in the ways that we would like. So when we detect value differences with our family members, for whatever they may be, cultural, religious, I'm meaning different, maybe political values, sexual orientation, religious, all kinds of things, we might assume they're capable of interacting with us as we'd like. But that's actually not necessarily true. Just because our family members don't seem interested in what we're doing as self-development enthusiasts, it doesn't necessarily mean they don't love us. And as scandalous as this may sound, They may not care, and they may never care. So here's an intriguing proposition and a way to help you, our audience, take your family member's perspective. Now that you're aware that you might benefit from some muscle building for yourself to help you interact more skillfully with your family, have you ever allowed yourself to consider that your family members might also not have the muscles that would allow them to examine themselves, let alone consider your perspective? I mean, it's true. That is very, very common. And when my clients let that possibility sink in, that their family members may not actually be capable of meeting them, they usually experience grief. It's it's sad. But at the same time, they feel a tremendous burden because they realize that the struggle that they're having, it kind of just makes it a little bit more okay. People don't have to work so hard, and it takes away the blame, and it allows for forgiveness to come in. So, as I said, more often than not, our family members don't often mean us harm, just as we often don't mean them harm. So rather, they, like us, simply haven't and realistically may never develop certain muscles that would enable them to fully meet us in the ways that we'd like. And it's still possible for us to continue to grow to be able to meet them, so long as we're continually shaping our expectations and we're aware of the assumptions that we bring when we meet them. So the implication is that we have the opportunity and the responsibility to evaluate what's truly realistic, not only for ourselves, but also for our family members. And from there, we can cultivate the capacity to be okay with what is. So now, how might we do that? So our sitting practice, meditation, plays a fundamental role here. It's one thing, but it's really a powerful one. It's a liberating developmental move to be able to discern and release whatever holds us back from attaching to unrealistic ideals, and to be able to accept what is without having to change it. The beauty of being able to be with what is that we find compassion for ourselves, for our family members. We come to appreciate what previously went unnoticed. And that's key, because when we're locked into what we want to change and how we're hurting, there are many other things we're not experiencing that might allow for new ways of relating. So we also have the invitation and responsibility to create more preferred ways of being. And so, for example, that may or may not depend upon our family members changing to meet our expectations. It might mean meeting them in ways that they're comfortable with so that people have a win-win relationship. And then maybe it means creating a larger family of choice somewhere else and really soaking in all of the juicy types of relating that we enjoy as self-development enthusiasts. And furthermore, it's vital to ask ourselves what would be required of us to meet our family members where they are. That might be a little bit harder at first, but it can really begin by simply asking them what they appreciate and what they value and what it was like for them growing up, if we're talking to parents, for example, a different cohort.
Yeah, this is one that I really related to, Susan, and I remember in listening back to the session with Wee, when he said something to the effect of, what am I supposed to do? Am I just supposed to go up to them and say, so what's challenging you? Remember that question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I so got that because it you know, you sit there and go, all right, these are all the great things I want to do. But, I mean, how do I actually do that skillfully? How do I actually not jump in with huge expectations that somehow I'm keeping some scoreboard about whether, you know, we've actually had the conversation or not, right?
Right.
And then stay open to those surprises. That's the one that when I can hold this a little lighter, is that there may be some moment within these holiday seasons where something just totally surprises you, some opening comes.
Okay.
And if you're actually really in the moment and present, sometimes that, you know, you can look back on it and decide, I just never would have expected that conversation to come up at that moment, or that
right.
way. And that really allowed us. But I never could have projected. If I projected that, it just never would have worked out and, you know, would have been nasty for all of us. So,
That's it. So
this next one, how to hold our emotions or how to manage our emotions when these feelings do come up. So what certainly that was something that we was asking you about and certainly something you helped him with. So let's remind the audience what this last one is, a really important one. What
well,
do you got?
To tie in with what we were just talking about and to weave it back to the keeping things simple practice,
mm-hmm.
if we pick a behavior that feels immense, our emotions are just going to hit the roof and we're not going to be able to move. We go into fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to managing our emotions really begins, again, with sitting and taking baby steps, just like shaping behaviors. We learn to crawl before we can walk, so it's about the developmental process, the muscle-building process. So, and that's especially true when we're developing our emotional capacity. So this third universal theme has to do with our being able to gain access to and to be able to manage our emotions when they arise. So for Hui, we started by helping him simply witness things such as when he laughed nervously. I would comment that on that playfully with him. Or when he felt irritated. And I would notice an irritation in his voice, both of which were signs of anger that he wouldn't normally identify as such. So he became aware that he actually has anger. But each of us can benefit from learning where we experience emotions in our body and what triggers them. And being able to stay present and grounded in our bodies is greatly facilitated, as I've said again, by sitting in meditation. It enables us to not rush into experience. And it gives us a space to kind of step back and to breathe and to consider how we might respond from a less reactive place, or maybe not even at all, if our tendency is to react in a way that seems to perpetuate harm for ourselves or someone else.
Yeah, that's... Boy, there's the heart of the matter. I mean, I can't think of one time when I've actually been able to do that, where I said, you know, I'm not going to react right away. I'm just going to take a breath, take a moment, and maybe not react at all in a certain sense. I mean, without, you know, but still staying present. I can't think of one time that later on when I reflect on that I said, oh, I should have reacted. You know, I should have actually said something, right? Or I should have just, you know, pounced on them at that moment and made a scene. I mean, I just can't think of one time whenever I do take the breath that I ever regret it.
So, yeah. Well, let's remember, though, in Hui's case, he has a difficult time bringing himself into the experience.
Yeah, that's
he
true.
Tends to be checked out. Mm-hmm. So for him, sitting can help him stay present to what's going on and to stay mobilized into what,
right.
to really notice what's going on around him. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we've been saying all along, we certainly can all relate in a number of ways. Thanks for those reflections, Susan. You know, for those of you in the audience who haven't listened to the first three shows yet, any one of them, that Susan's is really is reflecting on and talking about her in terms of sort of what came up with Wei's version of this story and how each of these three questions sort of resonated through his process, I would highly recommend that you listen to them to really get the full depth of the experience that Susan and we engaged in. It's really something to actually hear it happen as it did. Okay, so this is the moment that we've been talking about for almost 3 weeks now. We're going to present the three audience stories that we've selected for the Home for the Holidays contest. They are very different in terms of the way they engage this topic. It was really hard for us to pick three from all the stories that were sent in, but I mean, we feel that these three are really truly representative of very different perspectives concerning the common theme of this going home for the holidays. So I'm going to read, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to read a condensed version of each of the stories, and then Susan, why don't you, I guess we'll have you comment on the universal themes it actually contains. I just want to remind everybody that we're not actually doing coaching here for the individuals that may be listening tonight that sent us these three stories. What we're really doing is we're allowing them to surface the universal themes that once again represent these three questions that we want all of you and us to hold as we go home, you know, to our own families. And the last thing I'll say about this before I read the first one is that we have taken out all the names and the places in these stories that were mentioned just to protect the privacy of all involved. So we thank you all for the stories that you sent in, and we hope that this selection of three may hit some of the same themes that you all were talking about. All right, so this is story one. I used to live in my parents' house as a teenager when I went out to follow courses to foster my self-development. When I would come home, my mother would ask me to tell her what I had learned. However, when I told her, she would often enter a defensive reaction and quite angrily point me to the haughtiness of what I seemed to be saying. I had the tendency to withdraw and close down in such interactions instead of offering the necessary empathy, since I hesitated to take a therapeutic role. And quite frankly, I wasn't aware of all these perspectives at the time. In the meantime, I unconsciously embraced the idea that to be in relationship would mean to give up what one most intimately cares about. This really brought me to stress freedom in a relationship, even to the extent of not desiring to bond at all. That is beyond relationships that would not be serious enough to challenge that freedom I feel, how these assumptions have influenced my spiritual practice to a great extent and actually diminish my capacity to share what I've learned. Now 10 years have passed since I've moved out, and I'm even in my exterior quite a lot. I'm now called on by my family members for advice or talks if something actually is upsetting them. I feel it opens up our relationship to a new level where we can truly tune into the teachings and come closer to each other's life's worlds. When I respond, however, I often get into the role of a teacher or a relationship therapist with some close friends and family members, and even though I enjoy the fact that we're able to share our sorrows and exchange solutions, I feel like, you know, their equal exchange factor is somehow lacking. One aspect of the challenge is to come to terms with my own shadow and actually embrace the role of my parents as offering a most precious baggage, but also offering roles that I may learn to transcend in an intergenerational move that is collective as much as personal. It actually draws me to take up an inclusive attitude towards my own development and to integrate more and more my own past with all the relevant shadows. So here's my question. How can I offer my presence and my fascination with self-development without it being threatening to my family members this Christmas? I've been trying to offer the many gifts that I've been given in this life that have transformed my being and share them with my family that I want to bless with the happiness I feel when I'm engaged in such transformation, as well as allow us to come closer to each other and engage in each other's interiors, a desire we seem to share. How can I offer such gifts without expecting others to be thrilled by self-development on the one hand, but also take care of the shadows that induce the risk of taking up the role of psychotherapist in a warm atmosphere of a Christmas celebration? That's the first story. So, Susan, this story seems to have some of the same elements that we were talking about in Wee's story. Is that true?
Similarities and differences, actually, from my perspective. Mm-hmm. It seems that this woman has made strides in self-disclosing, so she's able to come out and bring herself into the experience. Although she's bumping up against a challenge of either feeling like she's educating in a way that's being received maybe as pushy or critical, perhaps, or even to become recruited as a family therapist. And I also really heard maybe a lifelong theme of, if I really come out and express myself this way, is it going to be accepted? And so I'd better hide it because it's so valuable to me. So there's similar implications that Hui was getting into. Wow, are they really going to value what I value here? So maybe it's better to just kind of keep things the way they are. Mm-hmm. So there's a desire to interact differently, but not so much at the same time. So she desires to move beyond educating to inspiring. And that's a really significant developmental move. So how do you do that? Mm-hmm. What would it mean to be able to offer a family member something without having an expectation, that you're truly being able to offer what you have embodied in the development and have them become really curious about it? So another way of saying that is to show, not tell, mm-hmm. or to walk the talk in a way that you're just being yourself. And then it's kind of like a magnetic draw for the other family members.
Yeah, this one was, certainly on we take our three questions, the expectations. I mean, there it is again with, you know, I'm doing all this development work. But it also sounds like in sort of the skillful means area that she actually has been able to find a way to have some conversations around this, although they, you know, she ends up still feeling like she's the therapist and not getting this, not getting a sort of a common ground, so to speak. My guess is the way she's saying is that she feels like, yes, she is informing them, but not getting a whole lot back. Am I getting that right?
Well, yeah, and I think what comes to my mind here is coming back to what's the emotional situation happening in her.
Mm-hmm.
What pulls are happening inside of her emotionally and physically,
right,
that she's finding herself going into therapist mode?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the internal conversations that are compelling her to do that? And then what would it require of her to pull out? So I'd be curious, what would be difficult for someone in this case to release? What value does she or someone in the situation have in offering this care? What's a way to connect, right? They're responding to me and I'm being of service, but it also has costs. So what's the risk in not stepping in and doing it that way? And that's what I would want to explore.
Yeah. And as she said in her email, we didn't include it, is that she's a definite candidate for coaching and for integral coaching in particular. That's what we're talking about. So, yeah, there's multi-layers and multi-moving pieces to that one. Anything else on that one before I go on to two?
Nope. Let's go on.
Okay. So here's story number two. The holidays have long been a time of emotional pain and challenge for me with my family. I have been an openly gay man for 20 years. Both my parents and my brother and his family are very conservative Christians. My current partner and I have been together for 7 years. My family will only allow me to visit them alone without my partner. This is because they firmly believe that gay relationships are inherently sinful. My parents have always been homophobic and unsupportive of my gay identity. However, for many years, my brother and his wife seemed to be quite supportive of me and my partner. They regularly visited us, and we also traveled to visit them and their children. But as my brother's children became a little bit older, he announced to me that he no longer wanted his kids to be around an openly gay people for fear that they would be confused about the morality of same-sex relationships. And since that time, I have not seen nor talked to my brother or his wife, although I do still speak to my parents over the phone. I feel conflicted in visiting my family without my partner. I feel that they are disrespecting me and him by refusing to even acknowledge our relationship in any significant way. They expect me to visit them alone and to pretend to be straight or at least not mention anything about my sexual identity. While I would like to continue to be able to get to know my four nieces and nephews, I feel that denying my relationship with my husband would be very disrespectful and hurtful to him. My partner is also deeply hurt by my brother and his wife cutting him out of their lives after being seemingly supportive of us for so many years. My parents continue to ask me when I'm coming to visit, and so far, I've told them that we will both visit once we have an invitation, which my parents have failed to deliver at this point. This dilemma and conflict have been very painful for me. I would like to have a deeper relationship with my family, but see no path forward in dealing with their religious-based homophobia. While I have sent my family literature to read regarding homosexuality in the Bible, they just seem to not be interested. I could really use some support from an integral coach. So, Susan, this is this is one of these stories that just has so much pain and sadness in it. I mean, unlike Wee's story, where his family basically gets along. I mean, in spite of all the challenges he was feeling and wanting to relate with them deeper, the way he would describe his family gatherings is they were, you know, friendly and that actually everybody was there, which in this case doesn't sound like that opportunity is arising. So when a situation seems to be this kind of closed up, what are your suggestions for what he can look for? What about his expectation? What are the skillful means for dealing with a difficult situation like this? And lastly, of course, our third question, how does he manage his emotions around this very painful situation?
Yeah, I really resonate with the struggle that he's experiencing. He's holding a tremendous amount of suffering. And so one of the very first things is, What would he or someone in his situation need to do to be able to hold that suffering and to find other ways of tapping into joy in life? Because holding that suffering is overwhelming. It's too much. So he's an example of someone holding the space are pushing the role of societal change. And so his ongoing challenge will be to hold tremendous suffering. But the beauty in that piece is that there's also a choice around it because he's very clear in who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a shift, it can be a shift in focus, focusing on the devastations, but also the heroism in what's happening.
Yeah.
And being born. So many of us can relate to wanting to come out to our families in whatever fashion that might look like. So coming out as we are. And yet, again, we fear rejection. So even Hui was experiencing this. And we might choose to remain hidden. We might try to convince ourselves or our families to embrace our values, believing that they ought to because they're family. And often our family members believe that we ought to believe as they do or do as they do. And unfortunately, some situations cannot be resolved as we would like. And again, it comes down to capacity, true capacity and also will, which behooves us to become willing in our own right and also able to accept that, to be able to accept what is. So I would invite those in this situation to consider how they will know when they've tried hard enough to earn their family's approval. Is it enough? Or what would it require of you to embrace the choice to create a loving family of choice with friends, perhaps other relatives, and in this man's case, also with his partner? And then potentially to consider visiting the family in a different, under different circumstances. So in this man's case, potentially, I'm not recommending this per se, but perhaps he completely honors the relationship that he has with his husband, his partner, and relates to his family on their terms so that it is a win-win situation, but that he's creating or storing so much more beyond in his life that can bring him joy and alleviate some of that suffering.
Yeah, this is this is one of these the universal, you know, types of stories. You know, when I know that when we may complain about our own family, oh gee, they don't listen to me or I don't talk to them in a certain sort of way, but we do hear these stories from now, you know, and again. And it has really nothing to do with the same sex relationship as which what we're talking about here. I mean, this can be in any relationship where some decision has been made that, you know, you can't come home with them or, you know, certain conditions get set before families can visit with each other. And in many cases, in this universal type of story, it is there just don't seem to be many options at all.
Sometimes even maybe the family has a rampant addiction of some kind or just that it's not actually safe to return to as an adult.
Yeah.
And so maybe the adult has engaged in tremendous self-development and they have come to a painful decision that it's actually not healthy for them to continue to go back and to still honor the love that's there and maybe find other ways of connecting, but to really be wise about what allows us to thrive in the world and to honor our purpose for being here.
You know, you pointed out the one opening that he's got is that he can visit them, you know, by themselves, not at the holidays. I mean, go have a great holiday with your partner and friends.
Yeah.
Do that joyously. Because the other choice is just to simply set your own conditions, like we were talking about, and that he just says, look, until this goes the way my conditions get met, then we're not going to see each other. And particularly with parents, this is one that I think we certainly get into this question of this whole inquiry of death. I mean, how do you want to leave your relationships before one or both of your parents actually, you know, move on in life? I mean, do you want to just leave it this way or do you want to actually try to make an attempt? So those are very, very deep and just primal questions that each of us has to come to our own understanding of. But certainly you've pointed up, I think, that even in this very closed story, there is one opportunity for him to at least maintain a relationship with his parents. And yes, he's going to probably have to visit them by himself.
Yeah.
But that just may be what he has to do if it's important for him to have any relationship with them at all.
Yeah. You know, and you're reminding me of something. I see this so often. Often when we do the thing that seems the hardest, So, for example, to pull back, to let go of the expectation, to grieve it, to grieve the loss. Sometimes we end up, the system or the family actually changes. And you end up maybe receiving what you expected, what you had initially hoped for, or something kind of in between. But it takes all kinds of emotional work and getting clear about values and noticing just expectations, all the different things that we've been talking about, to be able to make that most difficult move. And so I often am coaching clients around, what's the most difficult move that you're experiencing right now? And are you able to be with it and be open as an experiment to see how things shift as a result of your doing that and trusting that it's still going to be positive and that new things will open up?
Right, and that's that thing about surprises or staying open to what you can't possibly predict. And certainly we're not giving any advice here that he should do one thing or another.
Right.
But in a certain sense, if you never try, then you'll never know whether there could have been, just by you showing up, some loosening of their conditions that may lead to a more positive thing while they're still alive. So,
that's right.
If you don't show up, then and that's a legitimate choice as well, but you just never have the opportunity for it to change if you don't. Any final thoughts on that, on story two?
Nope. Let's move on to story three.
Okay. So here's story three. My son and his wife live in the northern United States. My husband and I went to visit them several times, always staying at a hotel. Then they moved to the East Coast in the same town as her family. We got a call from her mother who said that our son really wanted us to come there for Christmas. I talked to our son and his wife, and they said yes, that they wanted us to stay at their house. My son said we didn't need a car, that they would drive us everywhere. My husband and I really weren't too keen on traveling at Christmas, but because they were so excited to have us come, we decided to go. My son's mother-in-law called again, saying how happy they were to have us come. She said that we could come over to her house Christmas morning, where everyone would open presents and have a Christmas buffet. Our son's wife said that her mother always went all out for this Christmas buffet and for this morning activity in opening the presents. We had two bottles of really fine wine that we were saving for a special occasion, so we decided that we would ask my son's mother-in-law if they would like us to contribute some wine for everyone to enjoy with the buffet, and she said that will be great to share some great wine with our Christmas meal. We packaged up the bottles and sent them off. We arrived at the airport where our son picked us up alone. We went back to his house, and our son and husband went out to get some pizzas. The house was very cold. My husband and I looked at the thermostat, and it said 63 degrees. I asked my son if I could turn up the heat, and he said they were trying to save money, and they didn't want to. I said I would be glad to pay for any extra expense when they got their bill. He still said no, that his wife didn't want it turned up, and I asked for an extra blanket. The next morning was Christmas. My son came to me and my husband and asked who had turned up the heat. He looked at me and I said I had no idea that I had not touched it, and my husband was silent. My son said, yes, you did. You must have. By now he was actually yelling at me. I said firmly, do not yell at me. I didn't touch the heat. I have no idea what happened. And there was just silence. Then my son looked at my husband and, did you do anything to the heat, he asked him. And my husband looked at him and said, yes. And then our son started yelling at him, asking why he didn't say anything. I stepped in and told our son not to yell at his father. Later, I asked my husband why he hadn't said anything, and he said he didn't know. We all went to our in-law's house, which was equally as cold. They greeted us and told us to come in. They said they had received the wine and were looking forward to having it with the Christmas buffet. We all sat down around the Christmas tree and started opening presents, or at least they did. I was amazed at the amount of gifts they were giving back and forth. My son's mother-in-law showed us that there were some things out on the table to eat. There were some crackers and cheese and a few other things, including some smoked salmon. Since it was now noon, my husband got up and suggested that we open the wine. And then my son and his wife and her parents started talking, and then my son came over to us. I don't feel well, he said. I have a sore throat and I feel achy and I'm going home and you both have to come with me. I'm so sorry that you don't feel well, I said. Are we all leaving? No, he said, my wife is going to stay here. You have to come home with me, he said. Someone will bring her home later. We were quickly herded out. No one asked us to stay. No one offered us, give us any food to take with us or wine or anything. My son drove us to a Blockbuster's and told us to pick out some videos to watch. Then we went to his house. He went to bed. Before he did, I insisted on turning up the heat, which he did. My husband and I made sandwiches and watched videos on Christmas. His wife came home that evening. The heat went back down. She said she was getting sick, too. The next morning when we got up, my son's wife took the car and went to her parents' house again. I asked our son if there was something special going on at that house, and he said no, that her sister, who lived a few blocks away, was going over there. Our son said that we could watch television again. He said that he needed to stay in bed. His wife stayed out all day and came home for dinner. We ordered out. My son's wife said she didn't feel well. She bundled herself up in sweaters and a blanket and turned the heat down again. And then we left the next day. So, Susan, this is a completely different type of story around this Home for the Holidays theme. This time we have parents not feeling great about their visit to this to their son's wife's family. And as I was reading this, there was a lot of what, you know, sort of what information in the story, but not much why. I mean, lots of, you know, there's a nice narrative here, but certainly a lot of questions arose from me about, I wonder why this was happening. So as a coach, when you hear a story recounted in this way, what expectations are in play here? I mean, are there skillful means for dealing with this kind of a surprise sort of nightmare at Christmas? And how are their emotions actually being managed here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first off, the narrative is evoking a lot of emotion in me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm naturally wanting to find out how this person is experiencing the situation, and we're not hearing that in the narrative, right? So I'm wondering how this woman's making sense of her experience. When we use the term seeing, going, and checking, like we fleshed out with Hui's coaching practice, how is she seeing the world such that she's describing this very painful, what it seems like, story, the very disturbing story? And then what is she doing with all of that feeling? And what is she checking for inside of herself to confirm that she showed up the way that she did during this interaction?
Mm-hmm.
So I would want to understand at a deeper level what she's aware of in her experience, how well she's aware of it, to what degree. And I'm curious how she might explain her role in co-creating that event.
Yeah.
And what is evident to me, given the perspective of the story, is that she seems to feel challenged in directly communicating the discomfort itself and asking why things were occurring contrary to expectations, so to actually name the expectation and to understand why that's happening as opposed mm-hmm. to just facts. And then also just to be able to make skillful requests to receive what she wanted and needed. I'm yearning to learn more.
Well, this is another universal type of story. Certainly we've had the developmental story. We've had the one that was deeply challenged, the second story, not many options. And then this one now, you know, it all starts out great. I mean, it sounds like this is going to be, you know, sort of a postcard holiday, something we see in the movies. Actually, it actually is something we see in the movies. We actually see, you know, Chevy Chase or any of these people, as Steve Martin does some of these things where, you know, you have the big family all showing up and then, the movie just gets strange. And we can all be entertained by it because we certainly watch moments that we may have experienced in our life. And this sounds like one of them. I mean, this sounds sort of like one of those stories which was a surprise, and certainly seemed like a surprise, and then as things start to head downhill, there doesn't seem to be much adjustment or sort of saying, you know, so why is this happening in a certain sort of way, just sort of like we just kind of walk through it. But you can understand that, you know, that there wasn't a big history of this, that sometimes you can get surprised by these things and you just can't quite figure it out in the moment. You know, you're just going, this is just so strange. I mean, I thought everybody was so happy about us coming. And then, like, it just seems like there's something something we don't know, or something that was some story we haven't heard, or is there something going on here we don't know? Anyway, so it really can catch you by surprise, and sometimes you're just not great at sort of, you know, like dealing with that, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right?
But again, whether it's an ongoing thing or whether it's an experience of with families flip-flopping, you know, sometimes it's okay and then sometimes it's not. But just being with that element of surprise and being able to presence, again, we talked about using meditation as an example of being with the experience, about being present to the experience, what's going on. And then how do I come out and say, I'm experiencing some dissonance here. What's happening? And there are lots of questions I have around what's okay and what's not okay. So checking for what's not okay to do and checking for what's okay to do. Just lots and lots of questions here.
Yeah. Well, so three stories. And like we said at the beginning, three very different sort of conditions, shall we say, that all revolve around this theme and around our three questions that we want the audience to let inform their own experience with their family in this coming season. So anyway, thank you for your reactions to those and pulling those themes out, because as we said, you know, that there are particulars to each of these stories, but these are three universal sort of types. It'll be interesting to see how the audience relates to all three of these, and then obviously we've asked them to vote on the one that they think really deserves the coaching session. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the audience actually reacts to all that. So, Susan, the last thing we want to touch on tonight are some of the questions we've been getting throughout the process with this about the integral coaching process itself. And so why don't we get to those? We certainly understand that an individual coaching sessions, I mean booking sessions, can be a major commitment of time and money. And so if I was considering the value of, you know, should I do this, should I not, you know, some of those questions that have been coming in are kind of interesting. What are some of the questions that would be the obvious ones that you think that I would want answered if I was really considering whether integral coaching was the right thing for me?
Sure. I think a common one is, what's the difference between integral coaching and therapy?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I'll start by saying that is a very, very big question. And I want to talk about the things that are relevant to this piece with Home for the Holidays here. I personally have trained, experienced, and studied almost every single form of therapy and coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel the immensity of that topic. What's relevant here, though, is that the main difference between Integral Coaching Canada's method of integral coaching is from therapy is that only about a third of our work as coaches is done face-to-face.
Mm.
Almost two-thirds or even more of our time is spent developing the client programs and developing their practices. Whereas in therapy, clients will typically come and just have face-to-face conversation, and there's nothing kind of going on in between. Another thing that has become evident for those who have been listening to the show is that as integral coaches, we, in a sense, digest the perspective of our client to the best of our abilities. And offer them metaphors that we hope will capture their way of seeing and going and checking, which implies the developmental objectives or the muscles that are weak in their current way of being in the world. And then we can design practices to help them build that to get to the new way metaphor. So what's obvious, too, is that as coaches, we don't diagnose. We're not relying on the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The topics span the gamut. There's no black and white distinction about what's on off limits. And we're not working with those who are actively involved in alcohol or drug abuse or have extreme emotional distress or challenges just with basic functioning in life. So those are some kind of major differences.
Mm-hmm.
I would say another big question that comes up is, what's my length of commitment with this?
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
How soon can I expect results? And is this really worth my time? And what's going to happen to me when I'm in the process? I'm managing a family and I'm managing work and I have all kinds of things going on in my life. Am I going to be able to hold it all together? So a full process generally takes about 5 to 8 months, meeting anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. And in the first session alone, clients are experiencing significant insights about how they're perceiving the world and what they actually do in relationship to their area of concern and how they're checking to confirm that they should be doing what they're doing and believing what they're believing. By the offer conversation, that's landing much better, but they're not able to generate that awareness or knowledge on their own, so they're not able to sustain a change by themselves at that point to really understand it. So by midpoint, in a full process, clients' new capacities are already coming on the line, and so they're seeing that they're doing something different. As their current capacities, like their normal way that they started with, that's really changing significantly, almost like disintegrating in a way. And that's an extreme term, but there's a dying process that kind of happens as they're feeling this exciting new life and growth coming out of them. And then by the second half of the coaching process, their strength and the excitement around how things are just popping out of them naturally is tremendous and exciting. And the way we calibrate whether someone has fully embodied the objectives of the program, and it's not something that just the coaches decide, it's something that the client and coach are aware of simultaneously, is can the client actively self-assess or their own developmental process? So are they able to hold their current way of seeing and going and checking? Can they look at that and go, aha, there I am, there it is, very, very clearly? And then can they generate their own new behaviors, so like new practices, things that would really help them because they see, oh, there I am, I need to do this to help me. And then finally, can they sustain that on their own? Have they just fully embodied it so that the way they ultimately desire to be is just, it's a natural part of who they are now, integrated into that.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that I've noticed, I mean, just in I think this is why we were so pleased to actually let people have sort of be a fly on the wall and listen in to these first three sessions. And as you say, we're not, you know, there's going to be no solution at the end of that third session. Certainly, we've sent we home with certain practices, and we're going to find out after the New Year's, you know, how this all went, right? And there'll be, and it's always evolving. It's always going to change. It's always going to be, you know, more to do. But I found just in the three, those three initial sessions, that there's just so much that you guys offer, that is new, that allows me to sort of look at it with different perspectives, that even though that, you know, we're not all fixed, whatever that means, at the end of the third session, and certainly we're never fixed, there's still in those first real value in those first three sessions, that there you really walk away with a lot to think about, to, you know, to reflect on, and then to actually put into practice.
Absolutely. Typically the first three sessions can sustain someone for a good 3 months.
Right.
And then they'll often feel like, okay, I still have training wheels on.
Yeah. Oh, darn. You mean we can't get fixed after the third one? I'm still hoping. Yeah.
By the way, on the very first point, I just want to go back about the one other difference between, for people who are concerned about integral coaching not being therapists, Integral Coaching Canada actually has a way of training their coaches to know when to refer to therapy.
Right.
So we are ethical in from the top down. And I say a final distinction that clients often ask is, how is integral coaching different from other types of coaching?
Mm-hmm.
So what I would simply like, much has been written on this topic already. Integral Coaching Canada's website has a fabulous article. It's article number 1 on the website, www.integralcoachingcanada.com. And if you click under the resources tab, you can read about that. The Journal of Integral Theory and Practice, the spring issue, I believe it was in 2009, was dedicated to this method. And there's an article that talks about our assumptions about how change occurs. And we actually have those assumptions about what creates change. Coaches do, therapists do. And so Integral Coaching Canada created a unique way of perceiving change from all four quadrants, such that it's much more robust than other approaches, which typically only view change or validate change from one or two of those perspectives. So, for example, I can read a section of that. The view that we hold of our integral coaching approach is that for change to occur in a way that is embodied and sustained, the focus and attention needs to embrace and include all four perspectives of how change occurs. Our integral coaching approach employs a methodology that includes and enables the deep and penetrating insights that come to light through conversation, intimacy, and shared meaning, which is the lower left. Okay. Clients' ways of seeing and understanding greatly expand, so that's upper left, development. And systemic impact is readily examined and effectively worked with over time, a lower right process.
Mm-hmm.
Muscle building actions, that's an upper right, are on behalf of developing underlying capabilities needed to fully and skillfully function in this wider, broader landscape across all quadrants.
And the other thing I wanted to add to that, Susan, is that with all those resources, also, if you go to Integral Life, which is www.integrallife.com, and you will look up at the top and you'll see a coaching tab. If you click on that coaching tab, that takes you into a full website that has videos with the founders, Joanne and Laura, explaining some of the things that you're talking about. And actually, I find it real useful that I can actually see what they're talking about. So there are graphics. So then we start throwing around these terms like upper right and upper left and all that. That's all part of the integral quadrants. But there are very common sense ways to, you know, take all that information in. And all those videos are there within the coaching site, as well as links to the Aqua Journal article that you mentioned.
Exactly. And more will be coming.
Well, so thanks for taking those questions on. I mean, I certainly, it has helped me as we've gotten these questions and hearing your explanations and also working with Joanne and Laura and Lisa, who's running the coaching program for Integral Life, how this all works. Hopefully we've answered some of the audience's questions tonight about if they're considering coaching, that they really should consider integral coaching to be something that they can take a look at. So that's it for tonight, and thank you, Susan, so much for all the insights that you've shared with us, not just tonight, but all the coaching you did with We over the first three sessions. Any last and final thoughts before we all now head home for the holidays and we get to try out all the stuff that you've given us, and we're going to see just how well this is all going to help us have a wonderful holiday. Any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank everyone for being with us. It's been a pure delight for me, and I would invite all of us to remember Hui as he's heading home as we speak to be with his family. We'll be excited to hear his report in January, so please come back for our last call. And I would encourage all of you, no matter what your intention is going home to be with your family, don't forget your competence. Remember the competence and the capacity that you already have. And stay connected to the love that is available to you in whatever way you find that. And I would encourage you to just continue to focus on what you did well, what went well in this, and to be gentle and compassionate as you go.
Just one last time, the three things we want everyone in the audience to take with them tonight, those three questions that we started with, that we walked through the practice, and we actually saw Wee's version of these things, where Susan reflected on that, and then we actually saw those three questions at work in the three audience stories. And those, just to remind you, we want you to consider as you head home. What are your expectations for your visit with your family? How are you going to do whatever you're going to do with skillful means? And how can you manage those emotions when they do come up? We also need you to vote for the story of your choice, story one, about the person doing the extensive development work and trying to share that with their family, story two, which was the gay man's family situation, and story three, which was about the parents going home to their in-laws' celebration. And to vote, you go to www.integrallife.com homepage and click on the Home for the Holidays medallion on the left-hand side of the page. Find the show for icon on the show page and click on it. And then look for the link that talks about voting for your favorite story. and we're going to tally up the votes and announce a winner for the Home for the Holidays contest during Show 5, which takes place on January 12, 2010, when we all come back after the holidays. And speaking of that Show 5, you're going to want to join us and just see how it turned out for we and all of us using the practices that Susan has suggested. So this topic of going home for the holidays has certainly resonated with all of you, and we thank you for taking the first four parts of the journey with us. And we will join you again after New Year's for the fifth and final Home for the Holidays show, which is on January 12th. It's a Tuesday, same time, same station. And no matter what your situation, we just send you all our blessings for a happy and a meaningful holiday season with your family. Good night, everyone.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas if only